Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of murder. This is the first episode of the second iteration of You Never Can Forget, a mini-series made up of our ongoing coverage of the Burger Chef murders.
I first got seriously involved in the Burger Chef case thanks in large part to the robust online community that has grown around the case. People interested in sharing their research or discussing the ins and outs of the case with friends and families of the victims can join two Facebook groups, Justice for the Speedway Burger Chef Murders and the official Speedway Burger Chef Murders Unsolved Discussion Group. This community is such an important part of the case that we decided to talk with a representative of it. Hank, which is not his real name, is an active participant in the groups, and we have been impressed with the quality of his research and his insights. We reached out to him to have a talk about some of the theories and rumors that have circulated around this case since the night in November 1978 when Ruth Shelton, Danny Davis, Mark Flemons, and Jane Freet were kidnapped from the Speedway Burger Chef and murdered in the woods of Johnson County, Indiana.
We thought that inviting a sharp commenter to cover the highlights of the case would be a good way to kick off this second series. If you are super familiar with this story, know that we won't be covering much new ground this week, but we believe you still might get something out of the conversation. If you aren't familiar with the Burger Chef case, welcome. And rest assured, we will be recommending past episodes of the show to catch you up to speed. We will be covering some fresh material next week. My name is Anya Kane.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee.
And this is The Murder Sheet, a weekly true crime podcast.
We are continuing the multi-part look into the Burger Chef murders we began last year. Each week, as part of our mini-series, You Never Can Forget, we will be presenting you with new information and context on what happened. We don't just rely on what we've been told or what we've read. We have worked this case ourselves. We decided to do this podcast so we can tell you what we've learned and even clear up a few misconceptions. We're the Murder Sheet, and this is You Never Can Forget, the Retrospect.
So I guess to start off with, tell us a bit how you initially got into the Burger Chef case.
When I was a kid growing up, we lived in the area less than 2 miles away. My next door neighbor at the time that lived next door to my parents, his mom was from Mooresville area. And, you know, we would take her parents were still alive living over here at the time. So we would go over there and they'd go hang out, whatever. We used to actually go over there in the wintertime when it used to snow enough. We'd ride snowmobiles around the cornfield and stuff behind their house. So one day, I think we were heading over to that area, and this was probably mid-90s, maybe 94, 95, something like that. And we were driving, we were on Stones Crossing going past Timber Heights, which at that time was still pretty new neighborhood. And she mentioned to us kids, and, you know, there's three of us in the back of their custom van. She's like, hey, that's the neighborhood where they found those, you know, where they found those kids that were killed, you know, from the Burger Chef. And she told us this story about, you know, somebody that she knew thinks they saw them riding around in the van before it all happened. You know, there was kids looking out the back window with the windows fogged up. And that always kind of stuck with me. Like, that would be, you know, a horrible thing to go through. And so that is initially how I kind of became aware of it. And then, you know, as you go through the years, you know, you hear things on the newspaper and or on the news, you know, on the radio and on the TV, especially around anniversary times. And then kind of moving into my professional career, I became interested in it from that aspect of it, like all the ins and outs and what have I learned, you know, through what I do that can maybe help foster some discussion or maybe uncover something that might help somebody that's actually, you know, on the inside, that's actually officially working on this. So that's kind of been my interest with it, I would say.
Absolutely. I mean, you've done some really amazing research on this case. And I guess, you know, in terms of your own interest in true crime or other cases, have you ever had that kind of level of, you know, drive to work on other cases, or has it been primarily Burger Chef?
No, it's primarily Burger Chef just because of where it happened. I mean, you know, and where I grew up, just being so close, and it really hits close to home, even though it was, you know, before my time, but it's still so relatable because I'm so familiar with so many of the places that are connected to this thing. I think it's important to remember too, that this affected more communities than just, you know, the Speedway area. There was the area where I grew up as well. And it's kind of like that part of it doesn't get so much attention. And I'm sure it affected a lot of people there. I mean, just, you know, to live, I can just imagine what it would feel like to live around there at that time and know that potentially there's somebody, you know, roaming around out there that's going to, you know, kill. I mean, if they're going to kill four innocent people that are minding their own business, then what are they going to do? Are they going to do home invasions next? I mean, who knows? So that's one of those things that I think it kind of gets left out when people kind of discuss it, or maybe, you know, when it ends up in the media, stuff like that.
Yeah, the such fixation on the restaurant itself.
Right.
The location. Yeah, yeah, I found that too. And it's like the killing actually took place 20 miles to the south.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, you know, you mentioned your sort of geographic links to the case. You know, but I think, I mean, I think we see sometimes with cases and in true crime cases, people sort of like gravitate towards certain ones, and they're almost a community rises up around it. You know, sometimes it can be a very chaotic, maybe a little toxic community, and sometimes it can be very supportive. And I'm always fascinated with the Burger Chef community. You know, people who are on the Facebook groups, you know, I think there's a lot of real interest that, you know, in the crime, and people really seem to want to help, and they want to kind of go come forward with what they know and with their specialties. And that's sort of what you've done. That's what Kevin's done. That's what I've tried to do, right? You know, and people kind of want to come in and help. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? And I guess, like, do you have any other thoughts about what really draws people into this specific crime?
As far as being able to help and stuff, I think this is one of the things that affects a lot of investigative, you know, law enforcement investigative type work today, is what they call the CSI effect. And people say, see these programs on TV, which a lot of them are very good. They're very entertaining, but they see all these things that happen as in terms of, you know, crime scene investigation, DNA. And they want to look at something like this through the lens of today, the lens of 2021 or whatever, you know, 2000, whatever. And I think one of the things I try to do, like when I post stuff about, you know, DNA or this or that, it's important that people need to remember and stay, you know, kind of put themselves in that time frame, is that stuff didn't exist. I mean, it existed, but we didn't, you know, as a human species, we didn't really know about it except for like at the highest levels of, you know, biological science. And people just, I think, assume, especially when they get on these groups on like social media and whatnot, they just assume that has always been a thing. And until I think the first case where DNA was actually used was in the UK, I think in 87 or 88. And people don't realize that it's been, you know, that was a good 10 years after. And that's not even in the United States, right? So to have a stuff, you know, DNA used in a US court, I mean, they didn't even know until I can't think of a date right now. I looked it up once, but I forget whether it would even stand up in our judicial system. So I think that there's just a lot of assumptions made that, you know, law enforcement should have done this or they should have done that or whatever. And it's kind of one of the things I try to do is kind of point back to that, the reality that some of these technology, a lot of these technologies weren't a thing. I'm not saying you wouldn't be able to find anybody at a law enforcement agency back then that knew what DNA was, but I think they would be pretty few and far between, you know. And that goes for a lot of things, like the whole profiling stuff, you know, psychological profiling. You didn't really see a lot of that until well into the 80s, I think. So it just wasn't that big of a focal point back then. And I think it's important to look at it look at the case through the lens of what the technology was then, what the capabilities were, and kind of bring people back that, you know, they want to blame law enforcement because, oh, well, they should have been able to solve this DNA, blah, blah, blah. They didn't even collect evidence in 1978 with DNA in mind. It was not a thing. You know, nowadays, if we collect a gun, for instance, we're supposed to call someone that's specially trained to do it because of touch DNA, so it doesn't get messed up, so it's done the proper way. That was not even a remote consideration back then. So, you know, you're lucky if you got a blood type. So it's a different world. And I think that is always an important part to have in a discussion where people are talking about this, that to remember that.
Yeah.
And as far as what draws people to it, I think, you know, for me, it's been, again, the proximity to where I grew up, where I live, and just the fact that draws so many people to it is, you know, there's these four kids that are minding their own business and they get jacked from a restaurant at night for no apparent reason. And despite all the work that's gone into this over the years, still nobody knows what happened. And I think that's a big draw for a lot of people. And of course, you know, then there's those, the surviving family members are like, they've never had any closure. And I can imagine what it would be like to be in their position and like, what happened, you know?
Yeah, I always,
and trying not to go all vigilante on somebody that, you know, but then again, you don't know who to go vigilante on because you don't know who did it. So it's just that unresolved piece is really what it is.
Yeah. And I always say that I think the heinousness of the crime and, you know, like these are four kids basically working at a fast food restaurant. That's such a American experience, at least it used mm-hmm. to be, you know, and, you know, it's like, I always say, it, you know, it's a crime that cries to heaven for justice. Cause it's just like, why can't this be solved? Like this right. is a case that deserves to be solved. All cases do, obviously, but
yeah, for sure. But I think, you know, and especially I think of like all the, another thing that always comes to mind is like all the potential that was wasted with those kids. I mean, you know, I know you guys mentioned in one episode that, you know, Ruth was into computers and I remember thinking to myself one time as I was listening to one of the podcasts, I was like, you know, she probably would have been a millionaire today because I mean, you know, the time frame you're looking at late 70s, that technology was just starting up. And I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, she could have been, you know, Bill Gates. Or some, I mean, some, you know, you just don't know. And I think that goes, it's the same story, I think, for all of them, you know, that, you know, they had talents and there was just so much potential there that was just wasted for no reason at all. And it was just like, why?
Yeah, there's all those details you find out from talking with people who knew them, and like, you know, the idea that Mark was like practicing karate moves like shortly before this happened, like they're just kids, like, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember we were looking through Danny's yearbook and he was like in the Latin club, the classics club, and like both Kevin and I are obsessed with Roman stuff, so we were like, wow. Yeah. We probably would have hung out with him
you've been friends with him back then.
Yeah,
like, you know? you see that connection, and it's like it's really cool that, you know, I mean, some of the stuff he was interested in as far as, you know, photography, and he just seems like, I mean, just a really good, solid kid. I mean, all of them really. Yeah. From everything that I know. And it's just like, you know, why?
There's a lot of theories on the case and what might have happened. So we were hoping maybe we could go through some of those with you and sort of got your take on them, like, you know, discuss some of them.
Yeah.
You know,
what about Alan Pruitt and his story about Tim Willoughby? What do you make of that?
Pruitt, of course, was the man who says he stood outside the Burger Chef as the victims were being abducted. According to Pruitt's original statement, the perpetrators were Tim Willoughby and Jeff Reed, and the motive was drug-related. We discussed Pruitt's tale in depth in our episodes The Creek and The Backbone.
To me, as a matter of fact, I'm looking at it right now on my computer desktop, Pruitt statement. It's right here. It's been here for a while. It makes sense to some extent. I definitely wouldn't take it off the table. I just wish that Pruitt hadn't been, you know, drinking as much as he was, because we might know a little bit more. But I mean, it's understandable. You know, what are you going to do? You can't know when something that terrible is going to happen. So if you're out having some beer, what do you, you know, it's just the circumstances of the night, I think. So that's kind of where I'm at with that one. And I think if Tim was involved, I think he fled. And I think if he is still around, he's hiding somewhere, if he is still around. And I would be interested to see, you know, maybe an age progressed picture of Tim. So something like that, I think if somebody was to try to locate Tim, if he is still around, you know, that would be, I think, a useful tool.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. We've always said that we really would love for Tim Willoughby's face to get flashed all mm-hmm. around, because, I mean, when you think about it, either he is himself likely the victim of a horrible crime and was murdered himself and right. should be found, or he might have been involved with one or more cases. So it's sort of like either way, it's good.
I've often wondered, since he didn't show up to serve that jail sentence, if he still has a warrant.
At The Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/msheet or text msheet to 500-500. A weight loss journey can feel like a lonely struggle, but it doesn't have to be.
For so many of us, lifestyle changes like deciding to lose weight, adopting a nutritious diet, and taking up fun exercises are all about putting our own health and wellness first. But it can be really hard to know where to begin or how to keep the weight off once we've seen some progress. Quick fixes like soup diets and juice cleanses are unsustainable. There's a much better way to embark on this journey that over 200,000 people have already chosen. We're talking about the Row Body Program.
Here's how it works. Row gives you access to one of the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Their Row Body Program then sets up a comprehensive weight loss program tailored to your specific lifestyle, health status, and goals. In addition to the weekly shot, you get one-on-one coaching with a registered nurse that can help you adopt and stick with lifestyle changes like exercise routines and nutritious diets. It's a comprehensive program that sees participants lose 15 to 20% of their weight in a year on average. But the real benefit is that you keep that weight off. This is weight loss at its most sustainable.
With Row, the average weight loss is 15 to 20% of your weight in 1 year, in conjunction with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to row.co/msheet. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. Go to row.co/msheet. That's ro.co/msheet.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
So yeah, I think the 8,000 pound gorilla right in the case in terms of suspects is Donald Forrester.
Donald Forrester is the convicted rapist who confessed to being one of the Burger Chef killers in 1986. He then recanted his admission. In 1989, he repeated his confession and then recanted it once more. We discussed the Forrester saga in our episodes The Tank and The Confessions.
I think probably most of what he concocted was stuff that he'd read. Also the fact that there was no sexual component involved that we know of, you know, I would think that that would be something that would have made it out by now if it had happened. So that wasn't there. And then the 89 interview he gave, the one thing that kind of hangs me up that I think, and this may just go back to his knowledge of the area, but when he described the route that they took from 465, I know there's been some, it even seemed like the investigators at the time maybe didn't understand what he was saying or put two and two together. It took me a little bit to do it too, but to me, it sounded like he was describing that they did, in fact, get off the interstate at 31 and then went south to Thompson. And anybody that knows the area knows if you make a right there, that'll take you over to State Road 135. And I think that is the route that he described them taking. And I don't think that anybody really, at least to this point on a podcast, has put that together. I think it was, based on his story was, okay, yeah, we made a right on Thompson Road. And then I guess maybe in his mind, he equated Thompson Road with State Road 135 all the way down to Stones Crossing. So that to me sounded like what he was trying to describe. And it was a lot. I mean, it was only once, I can't speak to Marion County, but I remember in 89, they were just widening State Road 135 in Greenwood. It had been previously before that, it had been two lanes. And there was a lot less there back then. So I can see that as him describing a conceivable route. But that said, I still don't think, I think he just made too many errors in what he said, like, you know, the location of the stabbing and shooting people in the face and all that. And that's a lot of that's been like contradicted. So I don't think he was there. I don't think he was involved. Could he have found out about it from somebody that was? Maybe. Could he have just read things in the paper and, you know, putting two and two together with as much as he did know about the area? That it's possible. I think that's probably, to me, that's probably for him is more likely than the fact that, you know, maybe he was there that night. I don't think it's very likely.
And I think to me, something people don't necessarily realize about Forrester is he did sort of in his own mind have a reason to lie, given sort of trying to negotiate, you know, bring me to Marion jail. I don't want to be at Michigan State. And of course, to people who are not in jail or, you know, that doesn't sound like a real reason, but in his mind, it was. Yeah. And he was severely mentally ill. That's not an excuse for his actions. He was a violent piece of work, but he was saying things like he thought the warden was putting stuff in his brain. And so he was, you know, he was really trying to get out of there.
And I can definitely see just putting yourself, just getting into a situation like that where you're not, you basically have no hope of release. It's probably going to, you know, maybe he was a little bit predisposed to a mental health issue like that. And that was the thing that triggered it, that set him off. You know, you see that a lot with mental health type situations where someone will get into a situation and it just exacerbates whatever they might have, you know, this like underlying, and then the next thing you know, they're full blown, you know, either depression or anxiety or psychosis or whatever. Sometimes it's associated with substance abuse. Sometimes it's not, but there's just like a trigger. And I can definitely see where, you know, putting myself in his shoes, like, okay, if I'm going to be in prison for 95 years, like I'm going to lose it. Okay. And I can definitely see where he kind of went down that path for sure. Cause you're hopeless at that point. So
yeah, all you can do is better your immediate circumstances, which may mean lying to get into the Marion County jail.
Yep.
You know? I mean, obviously we're not saying there's no way Forrester did it. We don't know who did it, but you know, we think Forrester gets mentioned or, you know, gets touted a little bit too much.
And he did get a lot of press. He got a lot of press. His picture was in the paper. And I think to some extent, that's what he wanted to draw attention to himself. And then I think maybe it negatively affected, you know, I know Jim Cramer was quoted as, you know, people think, hey, they might think Don Forrester did this. And then, you know, someone that knows something doesn't have a reason to come forward and say, oh, I saw this, or I heard this or whatever. And that's kind of one of those things that it's kind of a double-edged sword, I think, with a deal like Forrester, because it does get a lot of publicity for the case. And I mean, at that point, it had only been 8 years after the fact, but it still got a lot of publicity. It got it back in front of people's eyes, but then it kind of led them to the conclusion like, oh, well, he did it. He confessed, you know? So it was good. It was, I think I can see where it was a good thing and a bad thing.
Wanted to bounce over to the robbery gang.
This theory posits that the murders were committed by a robbery gang that had been targeting Indianapolis area burger chefs. According to the hypothesis, something went wrong for the robbers at the Speedway Burger Chef, which resulted in the murders being committed. We covered this theory in the episode, The Robbers.
robbery gang is one that, you know, has been very popularized in the press, given Burger Chef lead investigator Stoney Vann of the ISP sort of talked about why that hit was his number one theory. But what do you think of robbery gang, and sort of where does that stand for you in this whole crazy mess?
I think it's possible. Why even take them away from the restaurant?
The victims in this case, of course, were kidnapped from the restaurant in Speedway and taken to a rural area on the south side owned by the Hager family. One of the arguments for the robbery gang theory is that some of the members were from the south side and so would have been presumably familiar with the area where the murders occurred.
If you're recognized, why not just do it there? And then, you know, we go back to the whole point of, well, they knew this, they were from Johnson County, they knew this area. Well, I think a couple of the guys were from the Greenwood area, but they were over more towards, you know, the county line and 31, you know, that neck of the woods. Then, you know, a few of the guys were from, I think, the, you know, Franklin. And it's a pretty good haul from where the Heegers property was to, you know, either of those locales. I mean, I could just see there being a lot more convenient places that were even more secluded than where the Heegers lived to, if they were going to take everybody away from the restaurant, to do what they did. And, you know, I go back to, if they knew that area really well, I don't see why they would have chosen it, because the proximity of homes, even at that time, you know, we hear all the time in the newspaper accounts, oh, it was a rural isolated spot and everything. There was houses within 300 feet about of where this, the whole, at least where the shooting happened, I think. Now, not having any, you know, knowledge of any official sketches or anything like that, just from what I've been able to put together from my own research, looking at aerial photographs and the old news clips, you know, where all the police cars were parked and where the officers are seen walking up out of the weeds. You know, I think there was a home probably within 300 feet. And then the owner of the property, which would have been Fred and Rosemary Heeger, would have been probably 500 feet at most at the end of that driveway. So I just don't see somebody that really knew that area choosing to go to that particular spot if that's what they knew they were going to do when they got there.
Do you have a preferred theory about what happened?
I don't. At this point, I lean more towards it being something that was somehow drug related. And I think that some of the people that were involved may have even been, you know, high on drugs at the time, or just unpredictable. And I also kind of, something about this tells me that maybe it was a younger group, or at least some components of the group were younger and maybe weren't really prepared to do what they did. And I don't even, and then this is just me thinking about it, but I don't know that even murder was on the table initially. If we look at what happened once they got to the scene, you know, most of your revolvers, we've never heard from anybody that has any inside knowledge on the case, if there was more than one gun. You know, we've just heard 38. We've never heard if it was both Danny and Ruth were shot with the same gun, or if one was shot with one gun, one was shot with the other. I tend to think there was only one gun there because it seems like they ran out of ammo. This is not a pleasant thing to think about, but I know Teresa said at one point that Ruth was not shot three times. She was shot twice, I think she said. So let's just assume Danny's shot three times, Ruth shot twice. If it's a 5-round revolver, we now have an empty gun. And like I said, this is not a pleasant thing to think about. It's not fun, but you have to put yourself there and really go over it in your head. So they run out of ammo, then what? They still have two other victims. Mark, to me, is the biggest question. It would be helpful to know, at least for, you know, my personal edification, exactly where he was. Did he run to the east? Did he run to the west, where Jane ended up? And I think the issue with Jane being stabbed was panic on the part of whoever did it. Oh my gosh, these people are getting away, and we have no other choice. We've just killed their two friends. Now we've got to get rid of everybody. And I think that's why she was stabbed like that. And I also think the knife is a really interesting piece to this. And I'd like to see, I know they released the picture of the knife that we all saw, but I think it would be very interesting to see, you know, if there's ever been any metallurgical testing done. Do they have any idea what kind of knife it was? Was it a commercially made knife? You know, I've heard speculation on another podcast that somebody made this themselves, and that's entirely possible. And it's also possible that it was a commercially made knife that just was abused a lot. But I own a hunting knife that is kind of similar in size, and at least from what I get from the picture, is similar in size and, you know, probably thickness and metal gauge and everything. I just don't see how it could fail like that, even with how it was used. It's that to me is just very, very strange.
Yeah.
And that's I don't have a pet theory, because I try to keep my mind open to everything, because there's just so much out there. And, you know, even as somebody that's not working on this in an official aspect, it's a point of interest for me. And I just look at it, you know, in my own time, and just, it's a good mental exercise for me, but there's just so many questions and so many possibilities. I don't think it's smart to, unless you have some real good evidence, I don't think it's smart to lock yourself down to any one thing. So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yeah. And I really like what you did just now, which is kind of like break down the crime itself, rather than saying like, here's the people who must have done it. Like, it's more of like, how could this have played out, and why would it have played out like that? Like,
it's not a pleasant thing to think about. And it's why I mentioned that I kind of posted my thoughts about it one time on one of the groups, and I was kind of upset. I felt like I may have upset Teresa a little bit by discussing it, but she was like, no, you know, it's fine. You know, it's one of those things that needs to be out there. But, you know, I'm kind of glad that particular thread, I don't think exists anymore, but it's just one of those things that has to be something you got to think about, because it can, I think, point towards a certain type of person that may have done it. It can point towards, okay, it was a kid that was, you know, high on meth or, you know, somebody that was using, you know, whatever party drugs were the big thing. I mean, cocaine was a big, you know, huge thing back then. Don't see it so much anymore, but that was a big deal back in that time period. And it's just, I think it can point towards that, and just the fact of how they ended up getting to where they were at, even to begin with, to that particular spot, was like, what was the mental process that went through? And I think there was a big lack of preparation on the part of whoever did this. And I just something about it tells me they weren't ready to do what they did. And then it happened.
Yeah. A lot of the crime scene speaks to some kind of panic or lack of preparation, not the kind of calculation you might expect, given that it's gone unsolved for all these years, which makes it even more frustrating, because,
right,
you know, it's just, they got lucky.
The bad guys got extremely, extremely lucky.
And I think that's why also, just, you know, for the research you do is important, because you're actually, you know, there's a lot of easy assumptions you could make just hearing the press reports and the initial kind of discussion where Mark was beaten to death, right? Okay, well, is that someone's angry at Mark? And then you find out actually he just kind of sustained one injury that seemed to knock him out and cause his death. You know, you mentioned the knife. You know, you think, oh, somebody was just so angry with Jane that it stabbed and broke off inside her. And you're pointing out that shouldn't happen with a normal knife. So what was going on there? Like, there's all these little details, and the location especially, where, you know, having those public documents or having that knowledge base or having a greater understanding of the crime scene actually paints a totally different picture than what you might expect just reading about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess we kind of went through some of the big theories and kind of generally some, maybe the weakness of being only theory-based and less, you know, evidence-based. I think in any case, we should all try to be evidence-based as much as it is tempting to be like, it was these guys.
Yeah. My boss tells me all the time, find the truth. Don't find the bad guy, find the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, then there's a lot of bad guys. I mean, if anything is a lesson from Burger Chef, there's a lot of bad guys out there, but there's not a lot of murderers necessarily.
Right.
And it can be a little bit, if people are violent and people are doing bad things, it can be a little bit tempting to be like, ah, it must be just this guy because we want to have an answer on that. But but that way lies madness, right? As we found.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, you know, if, other than the obvious question, who killed these four young people, you know, what are some big questions that you have about the case that you'd like answered that you feel like might further all of our understanding of what happened?
That's a tough one. Wow. I mean, you could go so many places with that. You know, what about the negative heel shoes? Okay.
These were a pair of shoes found on a bridge not far from the restaurant on the day after the murders. They were said to resemble a pair of shoes owned by victim Jane Freet.
Were they Jane's? Were they Ruth's? Who were they? I mean, who did they belong to? And I know we talked about, you know, evidence in that time not being collected with DNA in mind because it really wasn't they weren't aware of it and the great potential that it has now in 2021. You know, he didn't have that 78, but would that be something that could be looked at now? You know, as far as the car, I've heard rumors that ISP still has Jane's car. I don't think that's true. There would have been no reason for them to keep it beyond processing it. So, you know, we could easily look back and say now, well, yeah, they should have kept it because they could have got, you know, touch DNA off the inside. But again, in 1978, and I think Todd McComas made a great point on this, you know, back then it made sense to steal an employee's car and use it to get to your getaway car because touch DNA wasn't something that they were looking at. You know, they weren't processing vehicles in looking for that. So as long as they didn't leave prints, they're good. So I don't think that is super important because they probably still don't have it, I'm sure. But to the car, you know, when you go back and think about the car, okay, we think about the palm print that was left on the car.
A palm print was indeed discovered on Jane's car after the vehicle was found abandoned near a park that was a little over a mile from the Speedway Burger Chef.
And I would like to know if any work was done as far as maybe determining a time frame when that could have been left. I posted a thread on this a while, and it was more of an academic exercise for me because I didn't know a lot about latent prints and how well they're going to stand up to various weather conditions and what surface they're on, all that kind of stuff. And I learned that there's actually quite a few variables. You know, is the print made with just, you know, the sebum, the normal stuff from your skin, or is it, you know, grease or vegetable oil or animal fat or whatever? And then how is that going to stand up in various weather conditions? Like, I went so far as looking at what the weather forecast, you know, what the recorded weather was in Indianapolis around that time. And I learned that it rained a lot. So then that begs the question, okay, where was the car parked? What was this stuff? You know, what were these prints made out of? Was any work done on that? And it would just be interesting to find out, how long is a print on a painted surface like a car hold up under a circumstance like that? Because that could, you know, maybe be used to either, you know, hone in on, okay, was this print left on the 17th, the night of the 17th, or was it maybe, could it have been several days before that? You know, did Jane have a carport at her apartment? Just the little small minute details like that I think are things that would. And some of the stuff may have been answered, and some of the stuff may be in the files from back then that, you know, we don't know about just from the outside looking in, but it would be interesting to know some little tiny things like that might not seem huge, but, you know, they could point you in a direction.
Right. And yeah, it's sometimes those little things that totally recalibrate our understanding of the case, as you said, in a case where motive and why this happened isn't entirely clear. Or at least why it happened the way it happened, why there was kidnapping rather than killing in the restaurant, why different modes of killing. I wanted to ask you one more question, if that's okay. You're an amazing researcher. What are your tips? What are your tips for people who want to be good researchers when it comes to a crime like this, you know, either Burger Chef or one like it? You know, do you have any advice?
The most important thing is keep your mind open. Don't get tunnel vision and understand that, you know, what resources are out there. You can learn so much from old newspapers, public records, records that you might not even think are relevant. You know, one of the things we discussed was water well records in determining when a property was built, you know, stuff like that, that is just public information. You don't need any sort of, you know, legal process or anything to go out and get it. You can just, it's there. You just got to know where to look for it. And it is just amazing to me sometimes is how those little bits and pieces can connect when you're trying to build a bigger picture of something, you know, what happened.
We'd like to thank Hank for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Murder Sheet. As always, thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
To keep up with the latest on The Murder Sheet, please make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Murder Sheet, and on Facebook at MSheet Podcast, or by searching Murder Sheet. If you enjoy listening to The Murder Sheet, please leave us a 5-star review to help us gain more exposure. And send tips, suggestions, and feedback to murdersheet@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening.